Hello and welcome to Origins, the programme that asks musicians, creators, artists and writers where it all began, how it evolved and where it's at. In this episode, Sophie Porter and Andrew Payne travel to Norfolk to meet performer, improviser and composer Laura Cannell.
Like the whole year group had to go to Blickling Hall, which is like a National Trust place where Anne Boleyn lived for a bit. And I think that's like a classic Norfolk school trip, isn't it? It's like your state school, kind of everyone on the bus. And we had to go in like very weird makeshift sort of costumes of the Elizabethan period. So it was just all a bit funny. And I just remember we were walking around the gardens and there were people there. You know, we were like in groups being shown around and it was kind of really magical. And I just thought, wow, this is amazing, you know, this sort of enormous house and gardens and everything. And there were some musicians there who were in costume again, but like more proper, authentic costumes. And some people playing recorders and lutes and sort of early instruments. So that was the first time I'd seen early instruments. But I already played the recorder and I was already taking it much more seriously than anyone else that I was at school with, and I was having private lessons because I just really, really loved it. And they said, oh, does anybody play any of these instruments? Do you know what they are? And I was like, oh, that's a recorder, I really love it, you know. and I know these pieces. And they were like, oh, do you want to play something? So I played, and I still remember the exact piece that I played. So I was like eight, and it was Hornpipe by Henry Purcell.
Yes,
and it's just like, so. And I got home from school and I said to my mum, to me, that was like a really pivotal moment because I just always wanted to be a recorder player. Mm. And that's like a really weird, random thing to choose as your job when you're eight. And my mum said that I got home from school and said, OK, I know what I want to do with my life. I want to be a recorder player. I want to play music. And that's it. I loved the sound, but also I think maybe I was, my mum and dad are antique dealers and they got me a really cheap wooden recorder.
Okay.
So it made it feel really special, like really early on. And I think I really liked the sound. I really liked, one thing that I realised quickly is that I could like pick up tunes that I heard. So even things like EastEnders theme tune. I remember like going into primary school and going, oh my God, I worked out how to play this. And everyone was like, oh, that's really weird. But for me, that was, it was kind of cool in a, to me, it was just like working things out.
So and you I had
just,
a good ear. You could
yeah, I think I just had a good ear and I could do that. But it wasn't really like, and then a music teacher picked me up and they took me off and they, you know, and it was all like that. It was just, I just completely did it because that's what I wanted to do, and I was very sort of single-minded about it. But at my high school we had like a recorder consort, and so there were lots of people, but I still felt very like I'm the only one taking this really seriously.
So you were classically trained?
Yeah, so I studied the recorder. Basically, I started with piano lessons, but my sister and I both did.
Yeah.
But we had this slightly evil old lady who would hit us with a ruler on across our hands, you know, and it was like, oh, this is horrible. But also, I just didn't like the piano. I couldn't, I doesn't, and I still struggle with it because it's, to me, it's not physical in the same way, I suppose. I don't know. Anyway, it wasn't for me. I wasn't brilliant at it. The piano, we changed piano teacher to somebody that used to drive around all the villages. So he was like a travelling piano teacher. And he used to come and teach me and my sister. And but I was just like, I just really don't like it.
Yeah.
And I felt, you know, bad saying that I just don't like it. When I was about 11 or 12, I kept having piano lessons till I was maybe 13, 14. But he then said, oh, well, what about if I teach you the recorder, because I do Baroque music. And so then I was able to switch from piano to recorder. And it's then the repertoire of like the really early music, you know, medieval and Renaissance and Baroque music. And that's, I just loved it. It's like opening up this whole world of imagination of the past and history with this one simple thing that hasn't changed. And even then I felt really connected. I thought, I was always thinking, oh my God, these notes that are on this page are the same exact notes and order that someone was reading like 300 or 400 years ago.
So what were the touchstone pieces that you would have been listening to and wanting to play back then?
Monteverdi 1610 Vespers, that was like a really big favourite. When I was maybe 14, I got the chance to play one of the recorder parts. Yeah, well, I did GCSE music and I did A-level music. But, I mean, I didn't do amazingly. I did all right. You know, it was always the performance side that I was really interested in and just getting my hands on as much music and playing as much as I could. But I also wasn't really very disciplined with practising. You know, I would completely blag it. I remember specifically, I was doing my I did my grade 8 when I was like 14, my grade 8 recorder, and that's kind of like the equivalent of, is it GCSE? Grade 5 is like the equivalent of GCSE music and grade 8 is the equivalent of A-level, like standard-wise. So I did that when I was 14 just because I played so much. And I remember thinking, after grade 6, I thought, oh God, I just keep getting passes and merits. I wonder what would happen if I actually practised. So I just, because before I'd just been like playing the pieces and hoping for the best with scales and stuff. So I remember specifically thinking, right, I'm going to just see what happens if I like really for the next couple of months before the exam, you know, really learn it. And I got distinction.
You got distinction?
Yes, of course. Because that's what happens if you actually are a bit organised with it.
And did that change anything? Did that distinction sort of make you...
No, because then when I did my grade 8, I thought, oh, that's good, I know I can do that, but
I don't
need to, because I was more interested in the performing side. Yeah. So I didn't worry about the technical stuff. After my A-levels, I took a year out and went with my friend. We got on a bus that went from Beccles to Galway. There was like a special thing in the local paper with a bus trip, you know, like Lambert's coaches or whatever. And then, so we went there and then we hitched up and down the west coast of Ireland playing in folk sessions. So at this point, I just picked up the fiddle. So I started playing that when I was 16 and I taught myself to play that. So, yeah, go on.
Well, no, I'm curious to know why you picked up the fiddle.
So basically I have had all the sort of more classical and more classical Baroque, let's just call it classical for now, but all of that early stuff with the recorder. I had like the sort of more formalized education, as in, you know, grades and things. But when I was about 16, I saw people busking in Norwich and Lowestoft with fiddles and whistles and stuff, and also I'd heard quite a lot of fiddle on some of the recordings of my dad's, like Durham Miners and things like that. Lots of really interesting sort of Newcastle traditional folk and Northumbrian stuff. And so I just thought, I really liked the sound of that as opposed to classical violin, because I hadn't really heard much of it traditionally.
Yeah.
So I bought myself a fiddle at an antiques market that I was at with my dad, you know, like I was just sort of, he was doing his work and I was just like looking around the stalls. So I bought a really old fiddle for like £14. So and I put a bridge on and I put it together, and then I just listened to lots of music and taught myself to play like that. And by driving around all the sessions in Lowestoft and Yarmouth and Norwich, so as soon as I could drive, so when I was 17, and also growing up in a really rural place, I just literally just would drive off to all the sessions and sit in the corner and pick up the tunes by ear. Yeah, so I already knew I could learn by ear because of the whole recorder thing.
So when did the deconstructed bow and the double barrel recorders? I mean, I think I know what a double barrel recorder is.
Well, it's just two recorders at the same time.
But you're playing them at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
But what is a deconstructed bow? I'm not sure I know what that
is. So I can show you a little bit. I'll talk you through it.
Yes, please
for
do.
Radio.
Make sounds on violin.
I will. Okay, actually this is the wrong bow. So actually the first time I saw somebody playing with this style of bow.
Yeah.
It's not so much to do with the bow. You can use any bow, any violin bow or cello bow. Was at Snape. There was a folk festival at Snape Maltings, and I think it was Eliza Carthy was giving a workshop. And my band at that point, maybe I was about 18 then, so we had a band that had, you know, we were playing tunes in pubs. And so we were playing to people like in the line, like in the lining up to go into the concert. Mm-hmm. And then that meant we got to go to the thing for free, I think. I can't remember. Something like that. Anyway, so we went to the workshops and I remember her doing this thing with a bow where you take the end pin out of the frog, which is like the black bit at the end. And just make some creaky noises,
yes,
creaky, creaky. So now I'm just putting my violin on my shoulder, and then putting the stick of the bow underneath, and then the hair of the bow over the top. So it's kind of like it gives you a kind of hurdy-gurdy sound. Mm. So it's like the bow is always on, as opposed to always putting the bow on, which is what you'd normally do if you're playing tunes or classical stuff. So she did this, and she just did like this like 10-minute demonstration and then just got on with the rest of the workshop. And this had always been in my mind of as a way to... something I wanted to expand, but I didn't really know how, and it was like I knew it existed, but I used it for like one piece in about 8 years. But when I was doing my solo, basically when Horses Brawl stopped... I was looking for ways to expand what I was doing to see what I could do on my own and to develop and what could I communicate without just like playing a melody.
Yeah.
So this was a way to do that, and it's just kind of gone from there that I wanted to expand it. Shall I play you a couple of notes?
Yes, please.
Don't know what to play now. So you can get kind
of... I know what you mean about the hurdy-gurdy.
Yeah, it's got a really good continuous sound. It's kind of like you're constantly revving up the vibration. It's like plate spinning. That's kind of how I imagine it. It's like you're constantly pushing it. So the more you do it, you can kind of get it. So... so it's just something you can really build on. You can get huge dynamics and you can do loads of different chords. Do loads of lovely fifths. And you can do loads of stuff. Anyway, so, and lots of different sort of dynamics and stuff. Yeah.
Lovely, thank you.
So that's...
so was that another pivotal moment when you saw Eliza... demonstrating that?
It wasn't particularly. I mean, it was because I saw that technique.
Yeah.
But I didn't do anything with it for a long time. But it became... it came back after a kind of a moment where I kind of suddenly... a bit of an epiphany, actually, that happened just prior to then using the overbow. Which I could talk about, or should I remain mysterious?
No, don't remain mysterious. Tell us about your epiphany.
Well, I don't know if it's an epiphany. I guess it's like the turning point that we were talking about. And I was talking to Andre about this, my husband, who's also a musician. So we met when I was 19. So like my whole career and obviously his as well. But, you know, we've sort of seen. So it's easy to sometimes not know when... big things have happened, but you know, you get a bit of an external view. I think that the real point that changed how I thought and how I played was going to see the Boredoms at Altamont's parties in 2010, and they were doing a performance of Boredrum, which is nine drummers, and it was just the most amazing, expansive, totally dynamic, guttural thing. And at this point, I was playing with Horses Brawl, and we've been doing that for about 7 years. And still, I had a lot of baggage that I had to kind of undo from being at music college and going through a classical system. Even though the instrument I was playing is very... not, I don't know, it's like I spent my whole life explaining that recorder is a proper instrument, you know, because I'd done my undergrad and my master's in recorder playing. And so it's just like you spend your whole life going, oh, it's a really virtuosic instrument in the Baroque period. And then you have to explain what the Baroque period is. And then you're just sick of talking about it. So I didn't really want to talk about that anymore. So I was getting to the point with the duo as well, where we were taking early music and traditional music and we were reworking it and recomposing it, but it wasn't really, I was going to say dangerous enough, it wasn't really free enough. And so it's still very much in the kind of classical or recital idiom that I sort of thought was how you played, which was all about perfection and playing accurately and still not really understanding whether you're ever doing it right, because no one ever tells you. And you know, and it's just, even when you're like doing it professionally, you still feel like, oh, did we, you know, sort of tricked them. We kind of convinced them that we knew what we were doing, but we still don't know. So I didn't want to feel like that anymore. So this when I saw the Boredoms, it just opened up a whole other way of playing and a way of thinking. The whole time I was just thinking about this Boredoms gig, and I was just thinking about the feeling of listening to those musicians and it being this one massive sound that was just so, it was just really primal. I don't want to be like obvious because it was drums, but it was just, it was very, it was clean, it was really direct, it was really powerful, it was just so amazing. And it made me realize that I could just get rid of everything else. I spent a long time looking at lots of the music that I had played in the past and wondering about it, and then realizing that so much, there was so much anxiety tied up with all the different things, so that like I knew I didn't want to purely play Baroque music or purely play traditional music or any of those things. So I what I had to do was throw everything away, not literally, but just like try and empty everything out of, and start thinking that, I started thinking that everything that I've played over the last, I mean, that was, when was that? 2011. Oh, it's like 9 years ago. No, 7 years. I don't, can't count.
7 years ago.
7 years ago. So I was like in my early 30s. So I was just trying to think. For like the 20 something years, I'd thought in a certain way and I'd practiced and worked in a certain way, but it was making me really screwed up and not that happy. But then I thought, all of this music that's gone in must, I must have learnt something from the compositions, from the structures, from the sounds, from everything. So I sort of thought, I've got to learn how to trust that I must have a voice or I must have something to say. So that was kind of what I did. And then Andre was really helpful because he just made me go and improvise. He just said, go into the, because all the little churches around where we are all open dawn till dusk, aren't they? So you can just like, I'd spoke to the vicar and I was like, oh, do you mind if I just, you know, come and play? And they were like, yeah, just use it because nobody's using them.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you, because a lot of your recordings take place in churches.
Yeah.
And
because it's free.
Was that
it's
one
free
of the
and they sound amazing.
Well, they do sound.
Well, I had to try out lots, but the one, Raveningham Church, is my favourite one. And I was just literally standing in the middle of the church. Yeah. I didn't even necessarily have the lights on. It was a bit kind of very, like, nothing, no electricity, nothing. Do you know what I mean? Like, I just wanted just me and the violin. And I just would stand in there and I would play, and it would make me feel really anxious and weird. And I didn't want to do like free improvisation. I didn't want it to be just whatever happened spontaneously, but I also didn't want any control. So I was having this constant sort of struggle with, I don't want to play a tune, but I want to play music,
yes.
You know? So I just kept going and kept making myself play. And then I was thinking, all the time that I was doing this, going into the little churches, I was also teaching myself things like Bulgarian fiddle tunes and Macedonian fiddle tunes and Scottish tunes for the ballroom. So I'd spend like 2 or 3 months on each of different styles, and I got a bass drum, and that was slightly inspired by the Boredoms. And so I learned to play and bass drum with a pedal at the same time. So I was doing like quite complex rhythms with the Bulgarian and Macedonian stuff. And I was really pushing myself technically to be able to do that really well, so that then I could throw it all away and know that I put loads and loads of stuff in. So basically, once I worked out that I needed to feed and fuel the ideas, it didn't matter whether it was related to what I was going to, my output, I just needed to put something in. Loads of medieval manuscripts and Hildegard von Bingen, and there's a big collection of like 410 pieces from the Cantigas de Santa Maria. And there's this guy in Scotland, actually, who is called, he's in a group called Gaiter. I can't remember his name at the minute, but he's done four volumes of all of the Cantigas de Santa Maria. They're really good, and they're for performance. Performance editions.
Yes.
And so then I would start looking at those, because I wanted to strip it away to the point where I had no associations with it. So if you're playing traditional English music, you immediately, my head goes to a certain place, you know, it's like it evokes certain things. And same with like Irish stuff, which is what the repertoire that I learned when I was playing the fiddle was Irish sessions and stuff. So I needed something that was absolutely nothing to do with anything, but that still really felt, it felt more mine, because the East Anglian traditions are they're not my favourite,
okay.
You know, so I needed to do that. So then I would just take the smaller and smaller fragment of like going from 4 bars of notes to 3 bars to 2 bars to like just an interval of, you know, 2 notes, and then see how I could fill in the space in lots of different ways. I felt like everything had been about practicing. Yeah. And then again with the recording process, like being in studios just was driving me mad. And the last thing I wanted to do with this new music was explain to somebody what I was doing, because a lot of the people I'd worked with, I don't want to like poo-poo everyone I've worked with, but it's a very male-dominated world. So mainly it was men that I was having to then explain, I want it to sound a bit raspy. I want it to sound like that. And it's like over-explaining. And yes, I am playing two records at the same time. And I'm just so sick of explaining what I'm doing and justifying it that I just thought, well, what would happen if I just did it myself? You know, because I quite often record rehearsals in a church, and then I'm like, well, that sounds really good. So what's the difference between that recording and me going into a studio or getting a location engineer out here and giving them £1,000 to record this thing I felt captured the thing? Releasing albums as a solo albums, everybody that's reviewed it has talked about it in reference to my location and my influences. I never...
You don't see that.
Well, I do see it now that someone else has explained it, but I never set out to be inspired by the Marshes and to you know, take the acoustic of the church specifically. You know, I approach it in a very secular way, in a very kind of, this is what there is, and choose one which sounds and feels right. I started thinking about all the people that would you know, historically go to the church, and it was a much bigger, more important building in the, you know, 300, 400, 500, 600 years ago. Mm. But I like thinking about the people who were going, who might have been having their day off, because I tend to always, I think I always think of myself in the more servant area. Like, I don't know, that's not telling. This is part of the therapy session, isn't it? But like those people, it's like you get a chance to sit and think for yourself while you're not being told what to do.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's just, you would see all of the village, all of the community. And so that then becomes, you know, the voices in the walls, or the things that you're drawing out of this sort of hard but porous material. And I think that's definitely impacted and influenced. So I don't go, I know when it isn't there.
Yeah.
And then I just never really feel that comfortable. But then having said that, there are places I've recorded where I really don't like it and it feels uncomfortable, and I've recorded something and then run away and then listened back and thought, oh my God, that was like actually amazing. It right. just felt really, really hard. And what one of the things actually that I learned is that how it feels when you're recording it is nothing like what it sounds like. Right. So never stop halfway through a recording because you're feeling uncomfortable or weird or worried that it's wrong. Always try and get to whatever you think the end point is, because it could be one of your best pieces, you know.
You also seem to be drawn to just nature generally. I read somewhere about you were looking out the window, or you were in the garden or something, and you didn't have a clue, you didn't have anything in your head, so you started doing a transcription of birdsong.
Oh yeah.
And then you took that to Tower Hamlets and played it to the birds in Tower Hamlets.
Yeah.
And that they responded kindly.
Yes, they did.
Which is fantastic. is
that was here as well.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
So do you draw from nature quite often? Are you sort of attracted to or inspired by?
I think it's just what I hear. I guess I listen a lot to whatever there is around. I mean, there's a sushi factory. I'm sort of saying where I live, really, aren't I?
Yeah.
But I keep that secret.
Yeah.
There's a factory somewhere nearby which has these amazing drones that start like in the middle of the night, and it just depends, and you can tell like that's obviously their collection day, and it's a really, really big factory, but it's completely quiet apart from occasional drones. And so it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be nature, it's just whatever sounds
what's
there are
you.
And in the house that we lived in when I made the first album, we lived looking over some fields, and there were sort of marshes down to the left and loads of, it's like a very arable, no, you couldn't see any other houses, and then behind us was a wood. And then one day I was like just sort of in the kitchen or whatever, because I tend to always have the doors wide open.
Yeah.
If it's not raining too much, I'm just like the whole, you know, open it all up. And I could hear this like weird barking, and it didn't sound like a dog, and it was deers barking and calling to each other all the way through. So it's like echoing down this massive grove of trees. So I got my Zoom recorder and I recorded it, and then I turned that into a piece for two recorders. And that's kind of, so yes, it's never, I never go looking for it.
So you put Quick Sparrows out on Brawl Records, didn't you?
Yeah.
And that's your own label.
Yeah, so that was started for Horses Brawl, which was duo / trio, which sort of, yeah.
So was that essentially a label in order that you could put out your own?
Yeah, because we couldn't really find where we fitted, because we didn't fit into the normal early music stuff, and we didn't fit into the folk stuff. And so we had enough people that liked our music that we thought we could just make it ourselves. And then we kind of built it up and then got a distribution deal. And so it sort of became a proper label, not just a kind of, we'll just put it out, you know, ourselves, even though nobody cares.
Yeah.
It felt like it had enough momentum that it could sort of do that.
Thank you.
position where I'd had the Arts Council money, which meant that I could make it. I'd had the sort of epiphany that I just didn't, I had to make the music that I really cared about rather than worrying what people thought or where it fitted. And because I could do that and be completely open about it, anything that happened was like a bonus. Anything that, you know, I had absolutely nothing to lose is how I felt, like financially, emotionally. I sort of felt like I'd gone through all of that stuff. Yeah. And then about five or six months later, The Wire reviewed it, and The Quietest and Mojo and someone else, like Record Collector, places like that. And they were all completely amazing. And like it was in end of year lists and top 50 Wire albums and stuff like that, that I just had never, I didn't even know end of year lists existed. I mean, I'm not like, I didn't live under a rock, but it was just not a world, because it just wasn't something that I followed in that sense. Obviously I read The Wire and I sort of knew a bit of The Quietest, and Mojo was always this like, this magazine that I remember a friend of my mum and dad's would like leave a pile at our house once he'd read them. And so I was like vaguely aware, but it seemed quite guitar-y to me at that point. So I was a bit like, oh, what's this? You know, but I was still, it was the closest thing to something that I would be interested in apart from like Enemy and Melody Maker earlier, you know. But the response was, it was really, it was weirdly relieving. It's like they explained to me what I did, the way that they reviewed it. Totally captured and described what I did, and it made my music make sense to me, which is really amazing.
And did that encourage you to continue?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, I was going to continue anyway.
Yeah.
But I was definitely feeling like if I couldn't think about it in terms of people, I had to record completely in the, what am I making? I'm making this, let's just go and do it. And in fact, when I recorded the Cook Sparrows Over the Black Earth album, I'd spent ages like carefully gathering these little fragments of music and doing lots of different versions and working stuff out. And then I just drove down the road to the church that I was going to record in. And I got there and I had my fiddle and I had my double noted recorders and my Zoom, but I'd forgotten the folder with the carefully thingy music. And I just thought, oh, fuck it, I'm just going to, sorry, I don't know if I can swear on here. But I just was like, oh, well, I'll see what I can do anyway. So the very first track on there, Entrance to the Vault, is because I just thought, well, I'll start playing something and something is going to come out. At least I know something's going to come out now. I'm not reliant on sheet music. I'm not reliant on memory, but not like entirely, you know. And so I started playing, and then I looked down and I was standing on a flagstone that had carved into it Entrance to the Vault. Had an email from Laurie Goldston, who was that cellist from Nirvana, who played with Nirvana, but also does masses of her own music and is an amazing improviser and has done lots of stuff for film and dance and stuff like that. And she said, oh, I'm coming over to England. We'd met at something that she was playing at Cafe Otto. Someone else said, oh, this is Laurie Goldston. So we were, you know, standing outside, just having a chat, and I said, oh, I play the fiddle. I think we had the same agent at that point. And it was kind of like, oh yeah, nothing really happened. And I felt like, I don't know, I wasn't feeling like, oh, this is one of my heroes, but I was just feeling a bit like, oh, she's quite familiar, you know, anyway, but a few years later. So anyway, then I sort of got home and I looked her up and I was like, oh my God, that's Laurie Goldston. And because I already liked the playing. And so then, like a year after meeting her, that's when I got the email saying, I'm coming to the UK, going to do a tour. Do you want to do a double headline? So we'll do a solo set each and then do an improvised duo at the end. And so I was like, yeah, okay, that sounds amazing. And so we arranged it. She had some contacts, I had some contacts. We put the tour together. And then I can't even remember where the first one was. It might have been at Cafe Otto. And then we did something with, I thought, well, if you're here, we might as well record everything. So we recorded all the gigs. And then I was doing some stuff with Charles Haywood as well, and I said, oh, Laurie Goldson's coming, and he was like, oh, I'd really like to play with her. So then he put on a night at Lewisham Art House, so the three of us improvised together, so we've got a recording of that as well, which we haven't quite done anything with. And that was like, oh, I had a complete moment where I was like, oh my God, I'm playing with this person who was probably like the first influence, like really cool in a band person that I could have seen or experienced, and totally shaped probably how I thought about music, and that you could play like the cello or the fiddle or whatever in a band, and it didn't have to be just folk or classical or anything like that. But it kind of, it had disappeared from my mind for so long. And then I just sat there, you know, we were like having our dinner or breakfast or something. And I just thought, oh my God, this is so amazing that I was in Raveningham in a little village in South Norfolk at the age of 15 with this person from New Yorker who lived in Seattle, who then suddenly... we were like in London staying in a, you know, in a weird hotel or whatever on tour, just me and her, just talking constant, like we've been talking, just like total full on talking about music, talking about how to do things. And like now we email each other probably a couple of times a month, like really massive emails. And she's like, oh, I took on board what you said about starting a record label and doing it yourself. And she said, and I'm putting about 6 releases out this year, and I've got a studio here and blah, 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 and I've started this and that. And so we kind of keep in touch with each other and catch up with things, but really talk. There were so many similarities, like we were talking about as well, between it doesn't matter what the music is you're doing. And it's about that sort of single-mindedness and that focus. And then suddenly finding someone that you can actually talk to about that is really special and rare and important, I think, because I've spent a lot of time thinking, why don't I fit in, and why can't I communicate with people, and why doesn't anyone understand me, or why don't they care as much as I do? Why am I in this band with someone who is flaky or whatever, you know? Why am I like completely, you know, it makes you think that you're totally mad and OCD about everything. Yeah. Whereas actually you're just, that's what you do and that's what you care about and that's your job and your work and your life and everything. And so, yeah, I'm working with her was just completely amazing. Thing was, it sort of came about because I'd been doing a lot of touring on my own, and I just was feeling a bit disconnected. And then I was doing this performance because at the end of the road in Southwold, sort of the main road, is where Latitude Festival is held.
That's right.
On the Henham estate. And in a very convoluted way, I was booked to perform at Latitude through my agent in Bristol. And I was like, yeah, I can get there. So I went like literally 2 miles up the road. But it was just a whole kind of weird, it has to go all the way around the country for me to go, hello, here I am with my violin. And I was talking to a couple of people, Sarah Anglis, do you know her?
I know the name.
She's just won one of the Paul Hamlin Composer Awards.
Okay.
And does a lot of sort of robotics and experimental music, and also Julia Dempsey, who's a sort of artist and programmer. They were both there, and I was just standing there going, oh my God, it's really nice that there are people here, you know, that actually understand the world of stuff that I do, rather than feeling like I live all the way out here and then I'm suddenly in a festival and then I'm not, you know, again. And so we were just talking, and I just thought, oh, what I really want to do is to create something which there are people, several people involved, but I don't have to start a band. Because I didn't really want to start a new musical project. I just wanted to start something where we could all come together. So not a variety show.
No.
But in a sense of being like people bringing their specialism in, or, and also being inspired by what Modern Ritual means to them. So it started there. And so Julia said, why don't you get in touch with Cafe Otto, and I thought, oh, I don't know if they'll even, you know, because I still think that nobody knows who I am, even though I've had lots of good reviews and everything. Anyway, so I got in touch and they were like, yeah, definitely, you know, come and do that. So we did two nights there, or the first night there in early 2017. And then I thought, oh, that was really good. So I applied for some Arts Council funding and we got something like £18,000 to tour it around the country and commission people to write pieces. So Jen's Foghorn piece, Jennifer Lucy Allen's, that was part of that. And then Luke Turner developed a performance. Yes, Luke Turner from The Quietus developed a sort of a reading and a performance from his forthcoming book.
Out of the Woods,
out in January, end of January. And Charles Haywood... Charles and I developed a piece together called These We Hold Close, These We Hold Dear, and he did his 30-minute snare drum roll. So then we were able to take it around the UK. And then also, and Andre, who's my partner and musical partner on Reckonings, is an electronic musician and going under the name Hoofus. And so he's very inspired by the sort of natural world and rustic and broken machinery and stuff. So we all were able to create something new, and I basically did something different at each one, and then we did a performance at the end of each night all together. So that's what happened. It kind of came out of feeling isolated, and then became this whole big thing.
So what is next? As a kind of closing question, but where are you?
Well, I've been doing a lot of commissions this year, but I've also been working on an album. So I'm recording my new solo album in early December, and it comes out at the end of April. So that's going to be called The Sky Untuned.
Nice.
And it just kind of feels right, both historically and looking at sort of ancient planets and the untuning of the skies and the kind of basically the sound that's there all the time that you tap in and out of, the music of the spheres, that's it. So it's kind of to do with that, but also it's sort of experimental and pushing my practice a bit more. So there's that. I've just been commissioned to write another album, which will be for 2020. So I'm working on that this year for the Wapping project, which is Wapping Hydraulic Power Station. That's just happening, so they've just asked me, and it's really exciting. I get to use the entire building to record in the way that I do, and I've just been for sound tests, and it's amazing. Yeah. So it's going to be very much like the way that I normally work, but in London and in a very immense building, so it's going to sound really interesting. Yeah, go on.
When you think back to, did you say you were eight?
Yeah.
When you had that little moment.
About eight, maybe nine.
Okay, so when you think back to when you were eight and you saw those musicians playing their crumb horns and whatever it was.
Yeah.
And you thought, actually, that's what I want to be. And you reflect on the music that you're making now. Can you see a line? Can you see some sort of lineage?
Yeah,
there?
Completely.
Could you describe that for us?
I think don't know. I guess it's like I came from the sort of... So my mum and dad, with their folk and early music, so listening to that. Also growing up above an antique shop, I didn't mention that. So everything, I was used to everything being very old and having a history and having a story. And then much later on, after I finished my... did my master's, I was working for a folklorist who we'd known for a while and as a research assistant. So they're all of the kind of traditional and folklore things tied in. But at the time, maybe through my teenage years, I didn't think I had a tradition and I didn't feel connected to the East Anglian traditional music. So I spent a long time trying to find the thing that spoke to me. So that actually was kind of like the original traditional music, which is, you know, medieval music, where people improvise around ideas. So it makes sense. It makes sense that I studied Baroque music and medieval and Renaissance music. It makes sense that I taught myself to play traditional folk fiddle, and then I could draw on lots of different styles from lots of different countries, and that all of those things in the sort of medieval melting pot of like the Ottoman Empire and all of those things and earlier things where everybody was travelling and learning, sharing tunes. All of that has sort of fed into being here now where I can take fragments of things from all of those places. And not just for me, but for anybody listening to my music, a lot of the stuff that comes back to me in reviews or people is that it feels at the same time really, really new and really, really old and ancient and earthy. And I feel like I'm being myself more than I've ever been through any other music. So it kind of makes sense now. Does that make sense?
No, that makes perfect sense.
And it's just sort of... But it wasn't an easy, obvious way to do it. But, you know, seeing this bloke in tights and a tunic playing the recorder when I was 8, you know, but I didn't think it was funny. They were so good that they really properly brought it to life. I have never spoken to anyone that I was at school with about that. I might ask someone if I bump into someone at Christmas. I'll be like, do you remember that visit that we did to Blickling Hall? And they'll be like, no, but I remember going to Pleasurewood Hills, you know. That was the other it was like either a fun park thing or that, but to me that was like everything, and everything keeps going back to that point.
For further information on Laura, go to Twitter @LauraRecorder.